Chapter 17. Breakfast Again. Common Sense Party leader Redmond Vanderpost, MP, succeeded Chancellor Yorick Kane in the hastily called elections of 1988, changed the job title back to Prime Minister, and announced a series of innovative policies. For a start, he insisted that democracy, while a good idea for a good idea, was potentially vulnerable to predation by the greedy, egotistical and insane. So his plan to democratize democracy was ruthlessly implemented. There were initial issues regarding civil liberties, but now, 14 years later, we were beginning to accrue the benefits. The news on the radio that morning was devoted, once again, to the ongoing crisis of the week, namely, where the nation's stupidity surplus could be discharged safely. Some suggested a small war in a distant country against a race of people we weren't generally disposed toward, but others thought this too risky and favoured crippling the efficiency of the public services by adding a new layer of bureaucracy at huge expense and little benefit. Not all suggestions were sensible. Fringe elements of the debate maintained that the nation should revitalize the stupendously costly anti-smite shield project. Designed to protect mankind, or at least England, against the potential threat by an enraged deity eager to cleanse a sinful race with a rain of fire. The shield project would have the twin benefits of profligate waste of good cash, plus the possibility that other European nations could be persuaded to join and thus deal with Europe's combined stupidity excess in one fell swoop. Prime Minister Redmond Vanderpost took the unusual step of speaking on live radio to not only reject all the suggestions, but also to make the inflammatory statement that despite the escalating surplus, they would continue the common sense approach to government. When asked how the stupidity surplus might be reduced, Vanderpost replied that he was certain something would come along that would be fantastically dim-witted but economical, and added that as a conciliatory dumb measure to appease his critics, they would be setting fire to a large quantity of rubber tires for no very good purpose. This last remark was met with a cry of too little, too late from Mr. Alfredo Traffic Cone of the opposition Prevailing Wind Party, which was gradually gaining ground promoting policies of immediate gain, something that Mr. Traffic Cone said was utterly preferable to the hideous, long-sighted policies of cautious perceptiveness.
"What a load of old poo," said Landon, giving Tuesday a boiled egg for breakfast and putting one in front of Jenny's place, then yelling up the stairs to her that breakfast was on the table.
"What time did Friday get in last night?" I asked, since I had gone to bed first.
"Past midnight. He said he was making noise with his mates."
"The gobshites?"
"I think so, but they might as well be called the Feedbacks, and working on the single Static from the White Noise album."
"It's only because we're old and fuddy-duddy," I said, resting an affectionate hand on his. "I'm sure the music we listened to was as much crap to our parents as his music is to us." But Landon was elsewhere. He was composing an outline for a self-help book for dogs, called Yes, You Can Open the Door Yourself, and was thus functionally deaf to everything. "Land, I'm sleeping with the milkman." He didn't look up, but said,
"That's nice, darling."
Tuesday and I laughed, and I turned to look at her, with an expression of faux shock, and said, "What are you laughing about? You shouldn't know anything about milkmen." "Mom," she said, with a mixture of precocity and matter-of-factness, "I have an IQ of 280, and know more about everything than you do." "I doubt it." "Then what does the ischiocavernosus muscle do?"
"Okay, you do know more than I do.
Where is Jenny? She's always late for breakfast." I took the tram towards the old Spec Ops building to do some investigations. The escape of Felix 8 was fresh in my mind, and several times I saw someone who I thought was him, but on each occasion it was a harmless passerby. I still had no idea how he had escaped, but one thing I did know
was that the Hades family had some pretty demonic attributes, and they looked after their friends. Felix VIII, loathsome cur that he was, would have been considered a friend. If he was still in their pay, then I would have to speak to a member of the Hades family. It had to be Aornis, the only one in custody. I got off the tram at the town hall and walked down the hill to the Spec Ops building. It was eerily deserted as I stepped in, a strong contrast to the hive of activity that I had known. I was issued a visitor's badge and headed off down the empty corridors toward the Chrono Guard's office. Not the briefing hall we had visited the previous evening, but a small room on the second floor. I'd been here on a number of occasions, so knew what to expect. As I watched, the decor and furniture changed constantly, the Chrono Guard operatives themselves jumping in and out, their speed making them little more than smears of light. There was one piece of furniture that remained unchanged, while all about raced, moved, and blurred in a never-ending jumble. It was a small table with an old candlestick phone upon it, and as I put out my hand, it rang. I picked up the phone and held the earpiece to my ear.
"Mrs. Park Lane next?" came a voice.
"Yes."
"He'll be right down."
And in an instant, he was. The room stopped moving from one time to the next and froze with a decor that looked vaguely contemporary. There was a figure at the desk who smiled when he saw me. But it wasn't Bendix or my father. It was Friday. Not the mid-twenties Friday I'd met at my wedding bash, or the old Friday I'd met during the Samuel Pepys fiasco, but a young Friday. Almost indistinguishable from the one who was still fast asleep at home, snoring loudly in the pit of despair we called his bedroom.
"Hi, Mum."
"Hi, sweet pea," I said, deeply confused and also kind of relieved. This was the Friday I thought I was meant to have. Clean-cut, well-presented, confident, and with an infectious smile that reminded me of Landon. And he probably bathed more than once a fortnight, too. "How old are you?" I asked, placing a hand on his chin to make sure he was real, and not a phantasm or something, like Mycroft. He was real, warm, and still needing to shave only once a week.
"I'm 16, Mum. Same age as the lazy slob asleep at home. In a context that you'd understand, I'm a potential Friday. I started with the Junior Time Scouts at 13 and popped my first tube at 15, the youngest ever to do so. The Friday you know is the Friday present. The older me, that will hopefully be the Director General, is the Friday last. And because he's indisposed due to a mild temporal ambiguity caused by the younger alternative me not joining the Time Scouts, Bendix reconstituted me from the echoes of the might have been. They asked me to see what I can do."
"Nope," I replied in some confusion. "Didn't understand a word."
"It's a split timeline thing, Mum," explained Friday, "in which two versions of the same person can exist at the same time."
"So can't you become the Director General at the other end of time?"
"Not that easy. The alternative timelines have to be in concurrence to go forward to a mutually compatible future."
I understood, sort of. "I guess this means you haven't invented time travel yet."
"Nope. Any idea why the other me is such a slouch?"
"I asked you to join the Time Scouts 3 years ago, but you couldn't be bothered," I murmured by way of explanation. "You were too busy playing on computer games and watching TV."
"I don't blame you or Dad. Something seriously out of joint, but I don't know what. Friday present seems to have the intelligence, but not the pizzazz, to want to do anything. Except play the guitar in the gobshites."
"If you can call it playing," said Friday, with an unkind laugh.
"Don't be so—"
I checked myself. If this wasn't self-criticism, I didn't know what was.
All of a sudden, there was another Friday, standing next to potential Friday. He was identical, except he was carrying a manila folder. They looked at each other curiously. The newest Friday said, "Sorry," in an embarrassed fashion, and walked a little way down the corridor, where he pretended to be interested in the carved wood around the doorframe. "This morning I only had one son," I muttered despondently. "Now I've got three." Friday glanced at the second Friday over his shoulder, who was caught staring at us, and quickly looked the other way.
"You've only got one, Mum. Don't worry about him."
"So what's gone wrong?" I asked. "Why is Friday present so unlike potential Friday?"
"It's difficult to tell. This 2002 isn't like the one in the standard history event line. Everyone seems introspective and lacking in any sort of charisma. It's as though a heavy sky is forcing lassitude on the population. In a word, a greyness seems to have spread across the land."
"I know what you mean," I said, shaking my head sadly. "We've seen a 60% drop in book readership. It seems no one can be bothered to invest their time in a good novel."
"That would figure," replied Friday thoughtfully. "It's not supposed to be like this, I assure you. The best minds have it as the beginning of the great unravelling. If what we suspect is true, and time travel isn't invented in the next 3.5 days, we might be heading toward a spontaneously accelerated inverse obliteration of all history."
"Can you put that into a carpet metaphor I might understand?"
"If we can't secure our existence right at the beginning, time will start to roll up like a carpet, taking history with it."
"How fast?"
"It will begin slowly, at 22:03 on Friday, with the obliteration of the earliest fossil record. 10 minutes after that, all evidence of ancient hominids will vanish, swiftly followed by the sudden absence of everything from the Middle Holocene. 5 minutes later, all megalithic structures will vanish as if they'd never been. The pyramids will go in another 2 minutes, with ancient Greece vanishing soon after. In the course of another minute, the Dark Ages will disappear, and in the next 20 seconds, the Norman Conquest will never have happened. In the final 27 seconds, we will see modern history disappear with increased rapidity, until at 22:48 and 9 seconds, the end of history will catch up with us, and there will be nothing left at all, nor any evidence that there was. To all intents and purposes, we won't ever have existed."
"So what's the cause?"
"I've no idea, but I'm going to have a good look around. Did you want something?"
"Oh, yes. I need to speak to Aornis. One of her family's old henchmen is on the prowl, or was."
"Wait a moment."
And in an instant, he was gone.
"Ah," said the other Friday, returning from just up the corridor. "Sorry about that. Enloopment records are kept in the 12th millennium, and being accurate to the second on a 10,000-year jump is still a bit beyond me."
He opened the manila file and flicked through the contents.
"She's done 7 years of a 30-year looping for unlawful memory distortion," he murmured. "We had to hold her trial in the 37th century, where it actually is a crime. The dubious legality of being tried outside one's own time zone would have been cause for an appeal, but she never lodged one."
"Perhaps she forgot."
"It's possible. Shall we go?"
We stepped outside the SpecOps building, turned left, and walked the short distance to the Brunel shopping centre. "Have you seen anything of my father?" I asked. I hadn't seen him for over a year, not since the last potential life-extinguishing Armageddon anyway.
"I see him flash past from time to time," replied Friday, "but he's a bit of an enigma. Sometimes we're told to hunt him down, and the next moment we're working under him. Sometimes he's even leading the hunt for himself. Listen, I'm Chronoguard, and even I can't figure it out. Ah, we're here."
I looked up and frowned. We didn't seem to be here anywhere in particular. We were outside TJ Maxx, the discount clothes store.